close it. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to pick up after the Chagin. So our brains have perhaps been fried, taken away from us, and hopefully are coming back, if slowly, and hopefully will help to get those neurons firing again. By examining today, we're going to be doing a little bit of learning outside, but we're actually going to spend a considerable amount of time looking at a couple of key texts, which you have in front of you. We're not going to start with them quite yet, but relatively soon. And today's topic is, essentially, we're going to conclude our very brief examination of some of the key aspects of the controversy, really the polemics between the Rabbanites on the one hand and the Karaites on the other, in particular in context of the Babylonian Jewish community, the Gaonic period, but really it's something that, as we'll see, will extend throughout much of the medieval period. The Rambam, when he's in Egypt, spends a tremendous amount of energy fighting against the Karaite community there. It exists in Spain, as we'll see. As we move into the Spanish Jewish community, we'll see that this will not just disappear, but we'll circle back. But at least our summary or overview for the meantime, we're going to conclude, God willing, today. So what we're going to do today is essentially two things. Number one, to just finish our summary of the key personalities of the key formative personalities of the Karaite movement at this earlier stage in history, and then to examine a couple of relevant texts that I think you'll find quite fascinating. And then next week we'll start the transition to the Jewish community of North Africa, and we'll look at a famous, very famous legend called the Four Captives, which we'll stay to take a look at next week. Okay, so we had mentioned that the key personality in all of this is certainly Anan ben David. Anan ben David is the founder of the Karaite movement. We pointed out that his approach to biblical exegesis is really a mix between, on the one hand, literal interpretation, but sometimes dramatic, metaphoric interpretation. We also noticed that the Karaite religion, beginning with Anan, seems quite dour. There's a lot of fasting. There's not a lot of simcha. And it's hard to imagine why this would be popular to perhaps some of us in our day and age. Why would you want to, fast for 70 consecutive days, including Pesach and Shavuot? Aren't we supposed to eat? And he mixed Seder without food. It's just a very, I don't mean that day. Right. I don't know exactly. The truth is there are contemporary, actually found recently, there are Karaite Haggadot. I actually found the public a printing of a Karaite Haggadah from approximately 100 years ago. It's not that different from our own. It's very interesting, which itself raises kinds of questions. Really? Would you expect on the basis of just Torah Shabbat to arrive at this conclusion? So there's some question in terms of the notion of what tradition means in the Karaite community as well. More on that as we continue today, but certainly these are some of the key characteristics for Anan. We noticed as well that, especially because of his metaphoric readings of some of the mitzvot, whether they be tefillin or mezuzot, not to say that you stick your tefillin right in the middle of your head, but rather that it actually is a metaphor for attaching ourselves to the commandments, etc., that he comes under heavy criticism from later Karaite thinkers. They both revere him, and yet in many ways they disavow him. We pointed out that Daniel al-Kusimi, we'll come back to in a moment, who lives in the late 9th to the early 10th century, he begins his career, his intellectual career, by calling Anan the Rosh HaMaskilim, one of the great intellectual giants, and then by the end of Kusimi's life, he begins to change his mind and calls Anan the Rosh HaSichlim, the head of the fool. His stock dips just a little bit, and people start to short sell him, and that's just how it goes.
So who was that?
That's Daniel al-Kusimi. We'll come back to him in just a minute. And we said, to the extent that current scholars debate essentially whether Ananism is to be viewed as distinct from Karaism. Are those almost two different Ananites and Karaites, maybe, or perhaps even two different things? We then moved to the next major thinker. I'm not sure we really focused on him, but just to mention briefly, lives 75 years after Anan ben David in the 9th century, Benjamin Nahawandi. Last name spelled N-A-H. I mean, this is how it's usually spelled. That's not how he spelled it for some obvious reasons. N-A-H-A-W-A-N-D-I, Benjamin Nahawandi. And he's really considered by many to be the founder of the more familiar Karaite movement. He takes a harder line in terms in the direction of literal translation. He polemicizes at great length with the rabbis of his time. I believe he's contemporaneous, or around the time roughly, of Sa'ad Yagon. Rav Sa'ad Yagon passes in 842, so I think Sa'ad is a little bit earlier. but there's a lot of back and forth between him and the rabbis, and he doesn't mince words. The rabbis don't mince words. We lost a lot of Rav Sa'ad Yagon's explicitly polemical writings. You can only imagine what they might look like from what we know of his personality. So you can kind of get a sense of what this looks like. He rejects Anan's interpretations regarding a whole range of different areas. For example, the Torah says that there's a prohibition, lo sacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav, that it's not permissible, right, to plow, to mix animals while plowing. This is one of the three categories of kilayim, in which you mix hybrids, which are prohibited. Right, of course, we have shatnez, we have kilay hasada, which is planting in a field different types of crops together. and you have the notion of the prohibition among them against plowing together. Anan takes this in a metaphoric way, in a very jarring kind of way. He actually sees charisha as a metaphor, believe it or not, for sexual relations. It's actually how Anan understands it, which isn't necessarily what one might have thought upon a face reading of the text. And Al-Qusaimi says, this is ridiculousness. The Torah, if the whole idea of what it means to be a Karaite is to take the Torah literally on its face, right? So then that's really what we need to do. And so he's very scathing and dismissive of these kinds of very sort of far, what he considers far out interpretations that are metaphoric in nature. Now that we've finished examining the ketubah, I'd like to now move on to... Sorry, Lisa. No. I told them we held them off. They really wanted to jump straight in, and I held them off at arm's length. So you're welcome. Okay, so that's Al-Qusaimi. Nahawandi, the third thinker, already in the late 9th, early 10th century, so he's passing in the first part of the 900s, just to give a sense. Also Babylonian is, as I mentioned, Al-Qusaimi. Al-Qusaimi is both at the beginning a protege of Anan, not in the literal sense, he doesn't actually study with him, but in the intellectual sense. He views him as his mentor at the beginning, as I said. By the end of his life, he had already moved away, perhaps due to, in part, to the influence of Nahawandi. One of the interesting things about Al-Qusaimi is that he is, in certain ways, a proto-Zionist. He actually makes Aliyah. And he starts a whole movement, but his Aliyah is, of course, associated with mourning, because that's what we said. These early Karaite thinkers were drawn to a heavy dose of asceticism and the sense of a dour approach to things. He begins a movement that's now known as Avilet Zion, the Mourners of Zion, and sort of is critical of the rabbinic establishment and says, essentially, you guys have constructed too much of a happy-go-lucky religion. Hmm. Here we are in exile, right? And you guys are satisfied to live off in Babylonia, and the land of Israel lies in waste. And not only that, but we've lost our temple. And what are you guys doing over here? So he does two things. He says, enough with this. And he makes Aliyah, number one. Number two, the kind of religious cult or community that he builds in Israel is one that is in mourning and says, essentially, we need to have an immediate connection to that which we have lost to the best of our ability so that one day we can attempt to reconstitute this. Now, this is really fascinating because we mentioned, of course, that the Karaite movement has certain kinds of intellectual roots in the Sadducee movement and some of the movements, the Dead Sea sects, not directly, obviously, but there's certain kinds of connections and overlaps, which we'll touch on again in a few minutes, between these kinds of movements. And what's interesting in this context is that really the question of how to respond to the downfall and ultimately the destruction and the exile of the Jewish community at the temple after really each of the destructions, but in this case the second Beis HaMikdash, really was an open question, right? I mean, the question, you know, we essentially had a Jewish community whose central axis around which everything revolved had now been taken away. And how do we move on from that? And this is a real challenge for the rabbis, since there are all sorts of takanot and attempts to reconnect with the Beit HaMikdash that are born of that period. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in particular is active. He said, really, we know biblically, the lulav for the arba minim were only taken one day outside of the Beis HaMikdash, but we take it 7 full days, zecher lemikdash. According to many, the counting of the Omer nowadays is only rabbinic, because really you count from the korbanot that were offered on Pesach and Shavuot respectively, and yet zecher lemikdash we continue to count, and so on and so forth. Other prohibitions on halachot as well were meant to really to continue to foster that connection. But the question of how to reconstruct Judaism and what that looks like, it's obviously not a subject that's a really important one, was one that was open. There were different views that were expressed in the rabbinic period as well, in the Gemarot. So there's Gemara Bava Basra, probably from the Bar Kokhba period, so a little bit of a different kind of texture to it, suggested essentially all attempts to build family are prohibited during these kinds of scenarios, these kinds of times of war, times of strife, and so on. So there were different approaches among the rabbis themselves how to respond to these things. There were groups that were much more mournful at the original period of time. And so here as well, we have the Aveli Tzion, centering around the Karaite movement, are suggesting, no, the rabbis have built too happy, too forward-thinking a religion, and we need to go back to that sense that we just don't have our core. We're fundamentally lacking something, and that really needs to be the focus.
The tradition of saying on the Harvot Bavel before benching.
Yeah.
So when did that? When was that established? Because that that came to mind when you mentioned the morning theme within
the That's religion. Interesting. I'm trying to think offhand. It doesn't go that far back, I don't believe. It might actually be Gaonic or early Rishonim. I'm not certain, I'd have to check. My suspicion is that it's Ashkenazic. I don't know for certain offhand. My suspicion is that in the Ashkenazic community, in the wake of the Crusades and the Bibles and so on and so forth, there was a culture of martyrology that developed, that we'll examine later on in the year, and that this is sort of a part of that. We'll get back to it. We'll have more morning to look forward to.
Plenty of that. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, there was much cause for mourning at these times in Jewish history. Although, it's interesting, in this particular context, there really wasn't, and that's what's fascinating. It's one thing if you're an Ashkenazic Jew living through these traumatic events that essentially cause many of your communities to simply be wiped off the map, right? And you're living with a sense of fear from day to day, and you don't know what's going to be. So to develop a sort of a mournful attitude, or an attitude that's, you know, sort of a mixture between on edge and glorifying those who were forced to give up their life in sanctification of everything that your community and religion stands for, that's one thing. But here, it was a relatively vibrant, safe, secure community, and yet, so it's almost, there's a certain willingness or a certain choice that's involved in this in a way that doesn't exist for the Ashkenazi communities. That's interesting as well. So these are some of the key personalities. There's a lot more to say, but I think you get a sort of a texture feel for some of the key issues. And we should not underestimate, at least at certain points, the degree of influence of the Karaite community, the Jewish community, whether in Babylonia at certain points after the rise of Hanan, whether in Egypt or in other places at other times. So it was really split. By the time you get to the period of the Rishonim in terms of Spain, 12th, 13th century, certainly Karaites are not nearly as prominent, or it doesn't divide the community quite as sharply, and it's certainly a clear-cut minority which does not sort of vie seriously for major influence among most traditional-minded Jews. But that was not the case in Babylon. It was not the case in Egypt. There was literally a war for the hearts and souls of your sort of everyday Jew walking around down the streets, and it was far from obvious to the traditional rabbinic thinkers that they would, quote-unquote, win. Hmm. It was really, that was not obvious at all, and so that accounts for the degree of just the just sort of the wavelengths along which these polemics happen are all the way up here. And they're really loud and they're intense and they're visceral. So you have all of that. Okay, so that's just by way of sort of concluding our overview. And what I'd like to do now is to turn to some of these texts. And there's some really some really helpful material that I wanted to examine for items that I have here. We're going to start with the one that says Ariz Rav Amram Gaon. This is really not specific, as you'll see, to the Karaites, but I think frames the context. One has frames the context in a very helpful sort of way. And essentially, what you have here is an English translation of collected response of the Gaonim. This is a tshuva of Rav Amram Gaon. Now, just by way of introduction before we actually read it, just to note, we pointed out that the rise of the Karaite movement was clearly in context, that this was a tumultuous period in Jewish history in certain respects. And this is just a really interesting example of that. That gives you a quick overview, and then you can take a look at the question. We'll actually read it together. So I'm reading from where it says, False Messiah, Tshuvot HaGeonim, numbers 261. A question written to Rav Amram Gaon, as you can see from the dates. So this is the latter period of the 9th century. Concerning the false Messiah called Sharini, ours cut off, Sharini, who declared himself to be the Mashiach, many people were duped by him and turned to heresy. They do not pray or observe the laws of Kashrut. They work on Yom Tov, and they do not write ketuvot, phrase according to the rabbinical formulation. We'll get back to that. When these people return to traditional Judaism, do they require tevilah, immersion in a mikvah, or not? Or we know that if someone chooses to God forbid, convert out of the faith, so there was a tradition, really a halacha, that one should symbolically be tochel on mikvah before rejoining the Jewish community in such scenarios. So is that required here? Some say they should not be admitted into the Jewish community because they do not adhere to the laws of marriage and divorce. Besides the charlatan Sharini sanctioned adulterous unions, if we accept them as followers, they will intermarry with observant Jews. Do we have to be concerned?
Who was Sharini?
So we don't know very much about him. We don't know about very much about many messianic pretenders who were active around these times. Now, this is a not uncommon phenomenon. Those who study the history of messianism can go through dozens of these, probably in the Babylonian period alone, and you have this at other times as well. So the Rambam, a few hundred years later, is writing in Egypt, is a famous letter to the community of Teman, who are struggling tremendously with a false messiah. Again, we don't know very much about that other than from the letter of the Rambam. This is not uncommon phenomena communities is really struggling with. And this, to me, is very reminiscent of what we find much later, around the time of Shabtai Tzvi, and the Frankists, who essentially, they reject halacha, right, wholesale.
And eventually convert to Islam.
And eventually convert it out of the faith. So you have a lot of that.
Except for the Dewan man.
What?
Except for the Dewan man.
Right. So if you think about the period of Shabtai Tzvi, and these are just, it's not, tumultuous does not begin to describe, these are completely traumatic. I mean, these are periods of upheaval. They decimate the community emotionally. They sap all of our energies. They exhaust us. They confuse us. Really very difficult and painful times. There are even some scholars, it's not so widely accepted, but there are scholars who have suggested that a full 100 years later, the Hasidic movement is sort of a response to this, in part, and that the Misnagdim, who opposed to Hasidut, see this a full 100 years later as yet another reiteration of Shabtai Tzvi. That's trauma. I mean, we're talking, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm saying it's torturing the community, and no one was living anymore 100 years later, and yet these are the fights that are continuing in a community. There are plenty of other things that we can find to fight about. Unfortunately, we know that all too well, but those were the fights that were continuing to take place. So these are the kinds of things that really can really drain a community. And his answer, these sinners, although they went wrong and denied the authority of the rabbis, rejected the festivals of the mitzvot, and defiled themselves to be eating non-kosher meat, still, it is better to befriend them than to shut them out. Beit Din should impose a penalty on them for their past sins. They should pledge in the synagogue not to return to their former ways. Then you should accept them and not rebuff them. They are Jews who have strayed. We must investigate whether they practice adultery, and anyone living in their adulterous relationship must separate. Their ketuvot should be examined, and any ketuvot that is not written in accordance with their custom must be rewritten. So we're not going to embrace them wholesale, as we probably would not expect Rav Amram going to suggest, but it's a relatively sort of tolerant approach where he says that you're going to just cause a lot more damage if you push them away even further. So this is these are the kinds of challenges. So it's not external persecution. It's a relatively secure community. But after the rise of Islam, you have a certain kind of ferment, intellectual ferment that is taking place. And you have this, and these are very clearly they're when they convert, right? They're converting presumably to Islam. So these are the kinds of challenges that are taking place, and so it's not so surprising to see the rise of the Karaite movement in this kind of environment. Okay. Next piece that I gave you, the other side of that same handout, is excuse me, this is from a classic Karaite reader, a Karaite anthology by Leon Nimoy, who's one of the if you studied this in undergraduate or on the undergraduate or graduate level, these are some of the primary texts that you might encounter. So let's just take a quick look at this. Actually, take just a minute to read both the introduction. This is some of Anand's rulings. Okay, so you can look at the introduction as well, some of the laws. All right, so what was the Karaite Shabbat experience?
Cold and dark.
Cold and dark. Okay. Any takers? It's just interesting to see this from in an American environment. Like, really? That doesn't sound fun.
But it really gets to the heart of it, which is this kind of notion of the joy versus kind of some suffering involved.
Yeah, which
I haven't thought about it in that light before.
Right. Well, when you think of Karaites, and to me, when I was out of it, I always thought primarily about Torah Shabbat, Torah Shabbat, and that whole piece.
Right.
But that was really for them was wrapped. There may be some Islamic influence here. I'm not expert enough to know. It wouldn't shock me, but. I mean, yeah, there's really a sense that of sort of self-flagellation here. There's a sense of, right? And in a way, I think we can understand why there's a certain kind of ironic attraction to that kind of lifestyle, you can imagine, for some people. Or maybe you can't. This is a personality kind of thing. But one can imagine that you walk around and you see everyone, they're just kind of celebrating and it's laissez-faire and they're having a great time and the stakes of life are very high. And what do you think you're doing over there just partying all day long, is that really what the religious life is all about? And there are very serious matters here at stake, and for us in particular, we're a broken people. And so it's a slap in the face of all of Jewish history and all of Jewish tradition and everything that we pray for three times a day when we daven. So we're going to sit here, and we sit on the floor in Tisha B'Av and all of that. And we're a bunch of hypocrites for it. So there's something psychologically, I think, very sort of settling about the notion that, you know, that they're all over there having a good time, and we're the sober ones, and we're the responsible ones, and life's a really serious matter. It's not just a, you know, it's like Kohelet. I mean, like that's the kind of, you know, when we think about it, for those who miss Melissa's other take. So that's the, I think there's something to that. Now, clearly, right now, I want to point out also that three of these, three of these four are also, right? Well, let's actually go through. Sorry, I don't want a biased conversation. Which of these are lenient and which of these are stringent relative to the rabbinic tradition? Let's go through one by one. Number one, carrying a burden is only prohibited on one's shoulder based on a pasuk. Right, so this is relatively lenient. What they're saying is, even with that meira, if you're allowed to go out, right, unless it's on your shoulder, based on a pasuk. So this is lenient, and also based on a pasuk. This is what I might have thought about if I were thinking, what would a karai do? Now, I do have to say that if you take a look at this, the context, it has to do with Levim carrying in the Mishkan, and that's the Avodah Masa. It's not at all obvious to me that this is the forthcoming literal conclusion based on the psukim. The notion that you can derive easy, straightforward legal conclusions on the basis of Chumash or Tanakh, for that matter, is to me, I think, a pretty puzzling one. When you actually go through the exercise and you try to tease it all out, it's not really very forthcoming. The rabbinic response that really it's basically impossible to come up with a comprehensive legal system on the basis of Torah Shebichtav alone, and therefore there must have been some other piece to it, I think, when put side by side with the Karaite movement, at least for me, granting that I'm biased, but to me it resonates. It sounds right. It's just, you look at some of these interpretations, and part of the proof to the pudding is that there are later rabbinic critiques of the Karaites, and you even see it in their own writing alone, that essentially the Karaite movement is not unified, it is splintered. Because once you throw away the tradition, we have enough to be machlokas in the rabbinic tradition, right? That's plenty. But imagine if you throw away all traditional moorings. So, for example, you say the Priyat Sadar, forget the Esrog, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be an Esrog. So, okay, if you say that it's an Esrog, so I have sort of a core starting point, and then I can debate, okay, what are the criteria for it to be a kosher Esrog? And, you know, and how many thousands of dollars do I have to spend so that I can say I bought a Mehudar Esrog? And on all those kinds of things. That's fine, but at least I have an Esrog. But let's say I'm shorn of that. So it could be maybe an apple, it could be a peach, it can be all. I mean, it's infinite. And so Karaism really splinters in that way, and they really struggle with that, and it becomes part of these sort of the, one of the intellectual reasons for its intellectual decline is because they weren't able to come to agreement about very much of any, you know, many of the basics among the top tier Karaite thinkers.
So how do they deal, for instance, with the issue of lo tevashel gedi b'chalei v'mo? Do they interpret that literally?
They argue about it. Although that's a case where I think Anand takes it a little bit more literally, but he doesn't just... He moves from the rabbinic tradition, but I believe, I forget exactly how he interprets it, but I believe that he takes it as a metaphor. He says it's not just about cooking the goat in the mother's milk, you know?
So much for taking it literally, right?
But again, right. No, but again, so that's what... Now, as a matter of intellectual principle, in theory, you can say, we follow the text of the Chumash, we reject the rabbinic tradition, right? We reject Torah Shebaal Peh, we accept Torah Shebichtav. Now, any text can be understood literally or metaphor. There are different ways to understand any text on its own. The challenge is, well, how do you know when to do which one?
Right.
And how in the world do you build a coherent, single religious community
of
principles? And so that's what it seemed to many later, both rabbinic and also Karaite thinkers, and this really became a problem for them.
That's true.
Okay, so that's one. And then what about two? Right. So this is forbidden to light fires in Jewish homes on the Sabbath.
That's machmir.
Okay, right. Or to permit even beforehand. Right. Okay, good. It's right, even before, even if it lasted. Or number three. Is number three a new... It doesn't seem to me to be a new law.
It's the same,
right?
Thing,
three is really an elaboration of two. Right. All right? It's just... It's responding to a possible rebuttal. 100%. And then what about four? So here we have the prohibition of Amira La'akum, right? Essentially, of telling a Gentile to perform work, the Shabbos Goy.
Right?
There's a lot of Jewish history written about the Shabbos Goy. How is it Machmir? Now, wait a second. Yeah. In the Halakha, well, let's think about it for a second. Okay. Let's work it through together. In Halakha, am I permitted to ask a Gentile to do work on my behalf? In principle, we have a prohibition of La'akum. It's true that there are, there are discussions about hints in certain cases and so on. But in principle, right, as a baseline, there's a prohibition against Amir La'akum. Now, according to Halakha, is that an Isser Min HaTorah or an Isser Min HaRabbanan?
I don't know.
Lisa's right. It's an Isser, right? With as well. What? Doesn't make it okay. Just saying that for the recording. okay. Good. there are. It's a complex area.
Yes.
For sure. Fine. So it's an Isser Midrabanan. Okay. Now this, if I were to ask you, is this according to? Fine. So that's the rabbinic position. Now according to this presentation of Anan, so he says that Amir al-Akum essentially is prohibited. According to him, is it prohibited biblically or only sort of on that second level rabbinically? Well, how do you know that it's biblically?
Because they don't recognize rabbinic.
You don't have to read anything to know that. Because there's no such thing. Right. There's no category. It's either biblical or it doesn't exist, right? So it is what it is. Right. I mean, maybe there's some notion of tradition further down the line, but that's not what we're talking about here. So for him, it's biblical. So therefore, the prohibition is intact, and we don't know too much from this text about the scope of the prohibition, but certainly this is a stringency. So one is a leniency, but two, three, as well as four, are stringencies, which I think is not a coincidence, because that's really the tendency, the dour, right? The dour sort of mournfulness and chumrah, stringency, right? Not surprised to see that they kind of can go hand in hand. Okay, so that I think is really really significant, and it sets us up for the next piece that I want to do, which is not one of these texts. And that's as follows. What's fascinating about the Karaite rabbinic debate in this context is that you have, as well, on this basis, because of these differences in their legal rulings and so on, you have many polemics between them that we've mentioned. Now, when I think of a polemic, right, or if I ask you, what do you think of a, how do you, give me an example of a polemic. I don't mean an actual example, but what does it look like? What does it feel like? Right, where
it's an attack.
It's an attack. We're screaming at the top of our lungs. That's the traditional category of polemic. That's what we call an explicit polemic. Mm-hmm. There is, however, a more nuanced, and to me, in many ways, more interesting category of polemic, which is an implicit polemic. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'll get up on the rooftops and I'll scream my head off at you and tell you that you're wrong. I'll write it for all generations. And sometimes I'll sort of weave into my text an implicit critique of what you're doing for one of a couple of reasons. Number one, it's intellectually a lot more interesting in certain ways. It's kind of, right? It's almost a game. It's like a puzzle. How do I, right? How do I, it's one thing, okay, just gonna kind of put it out there, but it's subtle, that's actually really interesting. But also, when people read your texts, they will also, without even realizing it, come to the conclusion that this perspective is right and not the other one. Not everyone is going to want to read a polemical text, right? You know, frankly, if I'm in a particular community and everyone, you know, I'm not sure that I have an interest, I might want run the other way and find something that's a little bit more pleasant for my Shabbos reading material. So that's number one. Number two, sometimes I just happen to be reading another kind of text, which has nothing to do with the Karaites versus the rabbis on the face of it, but somehow woven into it is a subtle but clear, sometimes not so clear, sometimes clear critique of the other side. And you have this this in particular with regard to the rabbis and the Karaites. You have it as well in Jewish-Christian polemic. You have Jews and Christians just arguing about what sorts of things you can, what it means with Hadashah, this new covenant, right, and all these different examples. And sometimes you have much more subtle critiques. So I read a Zemer for to be sung on Shabbat, but woven into that might be a critique of the Christian perspective on Shabbat or the Karaite perspective on Shabbat. And you have many examples. I'm writing a commentary on Chumash. So maybe the view in the Midrash that I cite happens to be the one that works particularly well in a medieval environment that says, you know what, Ad ki avo shila, which the Christians understand is a reference to Yashka, to Jesus, so actually it means something else. And I'm just going to choose the quote, the, you know, and it's sort of like a wink-wink, especially in Jewish-Christian environment, where if I write explicitly, I might cause some troubles myself. Less true in the Karaite context. A little bit true, but not at all in the same way. So there, it's particularly attractive to write in a more subtle way, and it's sort of a way of confirming the faith for those who are either truly bought in, or even those a little bit on the fence but are reading my materials. So that's the notion of an implicit polemic. What I want to do is I want to share one example of that. According to some, there's some controversy about this. I don't have the right. Here, I'm going to have to try to remember. On the basis of the Rambam. First, I have to do some erasing and take a look here. Now, the Rambam writes about this topic, the laws of Shabbat, at some length. The Rambam, in his Mishneh Torah, discusses the laws of Shabbos over the course of some 30 chapters. 30 chapters. So now, if I were you, and you were writing the laws of Shabbat, what might you start with? Okay, congratulations. You're now writing the Mishneh Torah. Well done. We're not even gonna go there. Okay.
The time it would start.
Okay.
So it started and ending.
Good. So the ending might be a chronological, and then also you might want to start with something along those lines, right? In other words, you might want to start with what happens before Shabbat. Are you prepared? That would be one way to structure it. Many sections of Mishnayot are structured in that way. For example, Masachet Pesachim starts with some of the earlier stages in terms of I have to check for the chametz. So you're the 14th, and then you get to the day of Erev Pesach, and they get to the afternoon, and then you get to the actual night of the Seder, and so on and so forth. So it's really sort of chronologically. Have many of those. Or Masachet Yilma, the work of the Kohen Gadol and Yom HaKippur. So you start with 7 days before he separates, and then so I'm sure you work your way up. So chronologically, it could work. What else? What else do you got? How else could you structure it?
A nice hakdama with the philosophy of Shabbos.
Fundamental, foundational philosophy.
Muktzah.
Although muktzah is mostly rabbinic, we assume, so it might be a little bit of a later. You might start with what are the basic, there's a mitzvah to say, there's a mitzvah lo to say, positive commandments, negative commandments. It's an interesting question. You have 30 chapters, go right, where do you start, where do you end, what do you do? Get a sense of the enormity of the Rambam's project. I mean, brilliant mind, it is what it is. So here's what the Rambam does, and it's curious. As opposed to other sections of his writing on Mishneh Torah, this is not necessarily what he expected. So here we go. The Rambam has 30 chapters. I'm going to try to see if I can do this from memory. I may have to pull over a Rambam. So here's Perek Aleph, is the, I would call the foundations of Malacha. What that means is, he talks about what are the basic principles that govern from the Torah, biblically, what you are and are not allowed to do. So foundations of Malacha. Which does not mean a list of the specific 39, the list of the 39. What this is if something is prohibited, what are the basic rules? What if I have intention, what if I do not have intention? Right? And so on and so forth. So the basic rules that govern that. Now, check this out. Sorry if I'm blocking anyone. Perek Bet of the 30 chapters of Shabbat talks about the laws of Pikuach Nefesh, meaning what?
Saving
the life. So the Rambam writes, you're allowed to violate the Shabbat to save a life. Okay, so that's Perek Bet. Perek Gimel, I think through Dalit, if I remember correctly, are, check this out, Amira Le'akum.
Yeah.
Is that right? No, I'm getting confused. That's Perikov. Sorry, I apologize. I'm wrong. That's Perikov. Sorry. Paragimel through Dalad. I'm remembering. Paragimel through Dalad are someone who starts, this is sort of similar to Jerry, someone who starts Melacha
before
Shabbat. Like, this is what we would call nowadays timers and these kinds of things. Right? Can I set something in motion before Shabbat that then is active on Shabbat itself? Perik, hey, is about, get at this, lighting candles, like the mitzvah to light candles on Erev Shabbat, which in a way is pretty similar to these two, but this talks about there's a mitzvah to light candles. Perek Vav is about Amira La'akum. And then, in Perek Zion, the Rambam then begins to talk about what are the Avot Melacha, the 39 overarching categories of Malacha and Sheva. Then, in, I would say, Perek Chet, through, I'm jumping now, Chav Chet, so in other words, 8 to 28, so we're almost at the end, he talks about all the prohibitions against Malacha, all the details, right? And then finally, in Chav Tet, through Lamed, the last two chapters of Hilchot Shabbat, he talks about the positive commandments of Shabbat, which he comes back to lighting candles, actually, and preparing for Shabbat, and eating Seudat Shabbat, Kiddush, Havdalah, and so on and so forth. Okay? So, positive.
That's interesting.
Now, the Rambam is one of the most organized thinkers and writers of Jewish history. And many a Maimonidean scholar, especially those who are interested in the law of the Rambam, many Maimonidean scholars focus really on his philosophy, so they wouldn't necessarily hone in on this. But those who study the structure of his laws, which actually historically in the academic community there haven't been that many, but even in the academic community now, sort of the Frum academic community or wider, you know, in Israel, etc., they've started to ask questions like, what's the Rambam's intended structure in Mishneh Torah? And they've kind of paid some attention to Hilchot Shabbat, and they've said, well, this is kind of odd. I mean, if I were doing this, I mean, these are all important things, but, I mean, Amir al-Akum is only rabbinic, and the Rambam says so explicitly. The Rambam actually opens this by stressing that it's only rabbinic. Okay, and that comes before he gets to the Malacha at all. It kind of seems a little bit funny. And this may kind of make sense, but if you wanted to start with what's first, you might have actually put that up here, or maybe Perek Bet. But like, why this is here? I mean, like, it's kind of this first section. So you get to Perek Zion is really, it's puzzling. It's really very strange. And if anyone's familiar with Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son, outstanding historian, he's actually written about this. Some really interesting literature about this. So, any suggestions based on what we've discussed to bias the conversation at all?
Suggest as far as what?
How to account for the Rambam's reasoning and structure. Well, he doesn't tell us why he structures it in one way.
To the Karaites?
That's sort of the suggestion that Dr. Soloveitchik offers.
Right.
Which is really, I mean, think about it, it's very interesting.
It's a polemic.
Essentially. So, this we haven't learned this halacha, but the Karaites believe that Shabbat is, among others, there were some, at least some Karaite thinkers, among early thinkers, who disagreed with the notion that Shabbat supersedes a life. Okay? Remember, right, goes to the medicine, but not it's connected to that, but it's not only that. This, the notion that Shabbat, remember, Shabbat is one of the most foundational, right, mitzvot in all of the Torah. And we have big three, right? We have Avodah Zarah, Gila Re'ah, Shfichut Damim, which supersede a life. In principle, right. We say that it's better to be killed rather than violate those. If I told you there are three categories of mitzvot in the Torah that supersede a life, and you don't go identify them, I wouldn't have been shocked if someone put Shabbat on that list. And in fact, the rabbis themselves needed to prove and discuss this, whether or not it's so obvious that Shabbat is not on that list. It wasn't a given. And if you take a look at this, the first and second century literature, some of the other sects disagreed with the rabbis on this matter. And they concluded that, in fact, Shabbos overcomes life. And some Karaite thinkers as well. So the Rambam puts Pikuach Nefesh here. Now, we just read that Anan explicitly said...
That's what took me off.
Right? That's right. That prohibited to start Malacha before Shabbat, right? Wow. And he described lighting candles on Erev Shabbat. For the rabbis is a mitzvah, and for the Karaites, if you leave it on Shabbat, right?
Yisur.
Right? That's an Yisur. That's Lo Tavaru Ish B'chol Moshvot Echem B'yom HaShabbat. That's the beginning of Parsha Vayakel. That's what we just... That's where they learned this notion. That's also scripturally rooted. Amir al-Akum, right? The Rambam says it's only Midrabanan. For the Karaites... No dice, right? And then, what's the Rambam's all the Karaites? Then he gets to business. I am joking. You know, these are substantive halachot. But, and Dr. Soloveitchik and others have suggested this, the very puzzling structure of these halachot is perhaps best accounted for because the Rambam is engaging in an implicit polemic with the Karaites of his time who were extremely influential, and the Rambam is battling them in Egypt once he's there at every step. The Rambam writes the Mishnah Torah in Egypt.
Wow.
Right? So it fits really...
So, in essence, it's a defense of rabbinic Judaism.
That's exactly right.
Approach.
Right.
To Shabbat.
Now it's implicit. It's not explicit. It's not out there. It's sort of to the faithful or to those who might not get it. Now there are those who disagree with this analysis. Well, you know, it's not our issue now to analyze whether or not that's exactly what the Rambam had in mind, but ultimately we can't prove for certain either way because he doesn't really tell us. And sort of, are there other ways to account for this structure? But to me, no one, I don't know of any, actually I do know. I know one scholar who writes, he says, well, it's beneath the Rambam. The Rambam's writing a sort of an eternal law code. It would be beneath him. It would be inappropriate. It would be sort of, it would sort of be, you know, detracting from the sanctity of the Torah and its eternity to structure in this way, just as a sort of a time-bound polemic against a bunch of Karaites.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So at what point does it cross over from being a polemic to being apologetics? Because when the more subtle you are, the more you imply, it becomes a defense of your position as opposed to an attack of the other position.
I think that apologetics is a really important category, but here I don't see it sort of shading into apologetics. Apologetics is more to me actually explicit, but instead of polemicizing and attacking you, I'm engaging in a more defensive. So I see an explicit polemic and apologetics as sort of inverses or mirror images of one another. Right, one is offensive and the other one is defensive. This, though, I think because it's subtle, because it's implicit, I think is a little different than an apologetic, which is an explicit defense as opposed to an explicit offensive, essentially. So this is a part of Dr. Salvechik's theory, and this is not the only example. Now, there are other cases where it gets a little bit more sensitive. So, for example, the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. Now, no one in the world claims or questions the idea that the Rambam's 13 principles of faith are anything but the 13 principles of faith that he believes in. But there is a little bit of a question in that the Rambam leaves out of that list a number of essential ideas. So, for example, there are those who raise the question, why is free will not on the list of the 13 principles of faith? Etc. And we're not going to go through this now, maybe when we get to the Rambam, but there are those who suggested that if you go through, as a professor at Yeshiva University who's published on this, and there's some debate, but it's a prominent idea in the academic literature, who suggests that what's motivating the Rambam, first of all, to write the 13 principles is to defend Jewish faith against other faiths at that time, both Muslim and Christian faiths. Number one. Number two, that some of the specific examples the Rambam gives on that list are clearly, or all of them, are clearly in opposition to either the Christian or the Islamic position. And you can literally go through each and every one of them. So, for example, the Rambam writes there is one God and only one God, and he's completely unified. Okay? Okay, right? Hello, right?
Trinity.
Take that, Trinity, right? Trinity, yeah. Right? Take that, Christianity. Or later on, the Rambam writes, there is one greatest prophet, there is one greatest prophet, and he shall never be superseded by any prophet throughout the course of our history. Right? What's that? Right? Obviously.
That's good.
Right? Well, maybe, but...
Other false messiahs.
No. One, a prophet.
The prophet also.
Prophet, right? Okay, we'll get to Mashiach as later, right? To say, right, that's not right, so he says, right? Muhammad is right, Muhammad supersedes Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rambam says, no dice, and this is the one, and this is the only one, and so on and so forth. So to see, now again, some might be uncomfortable and say, well, what are you suggesting, that the Rambam is just engaging in polemics and so on and so forth? That's sort of akin to this argument. But I think the response to that would be, no, the Rambam believes this 100%. But number one, what motivates the Rambam to write this? And number two, so why, you know, to what is he directing this, right? He's not, it's not, a, God forbid, dismissive or, right, or sort of demeaning to our faith. Just the opposite. Imagine a leader who does not defend the Jewish faith against the attacks of other religions and says, well, I don't want to wade in, I don't want to insult anyone, I don't want to offend, I don't want to this, I don't want to that. What would we say about such a leader? Such a person, right? Say, right, that you're being derelict, okay? That's weak, that's frightened, that's not real leadership. So I think one can suggest that just the opposite is true. The fact that the Rambam writes both explicitly and implicitly in defense of the Jewish faith is part of his unwillingness to abdicate his responsibility as a thinker and a leader of the community.
I mean, maybe it's inevitable to be influenced by what's going on outside. Maybe it's not even conscious. I mean, I guess for someone like him, it probably was.
Right. Right. Well, he's a very self-conscious thinker, you see in the Mora. But yes, in principle, that's true. There could be someone. Sometimes there are just issues that are up in the air. That's just kind of right. 100%. That could be in at least in other scenarios as well. Okay. The next thing I want to take a look at is just quickly. This one we're not going to look at extensively. This is a Gniza document. I mean the one that says Ikalif. And I'm not going to read it fully, but essentially what you have here is the Jewish community in Ramah, which is really the name that was used for Israel at that time. If you take a look at the bottom footnote, there was some sort of dispute. The Karaites were apparently not permitting the Jews to celebrate to go to synagogue and to celebrate properly, and so on and so forth. And so the Caliph actually sends a charge to the local governor of the Islamic community in Israel, who's controlling that area, to essentially allow the rabbinic and Karaite communities to operate independently of one another, not to interfere with one another's practice.
Wow.
Take a look at the brackets. Karaites cannot be allowed to obstruct the way of rabbinic communal leaders by keeping them away from the districts of Jerusalem and Ramah. It's like they kept the rabbis away so that they shouldn't, God forbid, preach and influence the traditional community. So, you know, this just gives you kind of a sense of A, the kinds of tensions that they're, right? They're vying essentially for rabbinic leadership. They're not allowing each other to practice or to preach in this case. And then it gets so bad that apparently the caliph feels the need to step in and to mediate this dispute. This does not sound like a marginal group that has a small fault, right? They're really vying for the hearts and souls of the Jewish community, whether it be in Babel or in this case, in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Just because of the time, I'm going to ask, we're going to go to the next one. You can take a look at that more fully. And the last piece I want to look at is this really fantastic document. It's a little bit hard to read here. We're going to try to make it out, at least parts of this. This is our famous ketubah. It's not the only ketubah, which is Karaite, has a Karaite aspect to it. Karaites traditionally write ketubot until this day. They have their own tradition as to how to write it. We've already seen a reference to ketubah in the Karaite pieces that we saw earlier today. This is from the Gniza. If you take a look at the bottom right, you can see it says, if you read it carefully, the very, very bottom right of the ketubah, it reads circa 1092 AD. Anyone sees that?
Mm-hmm.
All the way in the bottom. I apologize. It's, well, I don't really, I mean, it is what it is. It's not my fault that it looks like this. Okay. What is this, and how do we make it out? It's true, it's even on these photocopies, it's even a little bit harder than it would otherwise be. Thank you. What is this? So this is, and we're not going to examine this in depth, but you get a sense of how history works and the study of history works and sort of the spade work that historians have to do. Forget finding the Gniza, but preserving the document and creating facsimiles that could then be, you know, in preserving it properly and studying it properly and then trying to piece it together without doing any harm to boot is a complicated process, but I think ultimately a very rewarding one. So what is this? This is, it seems to be a ketubah that mediates between the son of the Nasi and the daughter of a prominent deceased. If you take a look, for example, on the second line, where you can just start to read it a little bit more clearly. Actually, I have to give credit where credit is due. I saw this for the first time over this past summer. I was at a conference. Rabbi Kenny Brander of Yeshiva University was there. He delivered a sermon, and he handed out photocopies of this. So that's where I was first exposed to it. I tried to find it online. I couldn't get my hands on it, so I sent him an email, and he was generous enough to send it along. So he's that's how I was able to procure this. So we thank him. So if you take a look at the second line, it writes Maranan, see there, about sort of after it's no longer as blurry there. Maranan, Morenu,
yeah.
Right, excuse me, Virabinu. If you read it carefully, Nisienu, David Hanasi,
right.
Nasi something. So this is David Hanasi, which is part of how they were able to date it. And if you go, Hagadol Rosh Yeshivat Geon Yaakov. You see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So that's you have a sense. And
it's interesting that there's no spaces. Is that
the
yeah. place to write?
It's definitely tighter. I mean, I think that they used contracts in everyday ways, so a ketubah was sort of just something you would kind of handwrite and more comfortably. So now it's like written as a very formal document in the sense that, of course, it's a formal document, but it's sort of, we read it, you know, it's not familiar to us, this many of us, this mode of contract writing in the same way that it was. So I think they were just more comfortable in writing these kinds of things. And then it refers to the father of, I think, the bride on the next line. If you take a look, it's sort of about a third of the way, it says, Marana Virabana, Aharon HaKohen, right? Nocho, you see that where it says Nocho, Nuchu Began Eden,
right?
Mm-hmm. So that's the father of the bride. Havali Lintu Kidas Moshe Yisrael. For those who might be familiar with the reading, right? And some of the classical, right, familiar text is here, although it's not exactly the same. So it's the David Hanasi who seems to be alive, and right, that's, and then the bride's father is Aaron HaKohen, right, who has since passed. Okay, so then if you jump down. Right, you can see, for example, Aman. It's kind of hard to count the lines because at the bottom it becomes a little bit. So let's go from the top. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. If you look 11 lines down, just to give you a sense, okay? It's toward the beginning of the line, it says Bimitaltale.
Yeah.
If you can make that out. Va'afilu, yeah, Va'afilu min glima dal kaspai, or something like that. That's what we read in our contemporary ketuvot. Zelo ka'asmachta, which means that it is not sort of an unintentional sale, it is fully intentional. Utelo kitose deshtare, right, and so on and so forth, which again, and it's, right, suvas de tikun rabanan, right, etc., etc. So there's all of that. So there's that traditional language. Now, if you jump down, so there seems to be some sort of agreement, al nafshe, that the father accepted upon himself, nisi'inu, right, etc. Right, di'im, everyone has me, I'm on the 12th line, about 5-6 words in, di'im chas v'shalom, that if God forbid, tiftere nashe da, that if this woman should pass away, delo vlad, or below vlad, without a child, that there's some sort of arrangement, it's a little bit hard to make it out, that palgi nedunya dein levei avuha, it's the kiminhaga devnei Eretz Yisrael, and it's hard to make it out over there. There's some sort of arrangement that if she should die childless, that the dowry goes back to, or at least half they divide the dowry and half of it goes back to the father, right? Goes back to the Nasi's house. And then it says that there's an agreement that she accepted on her, or it's not on Afshay, it's him, excuse me, Shalot, that the Chatan accepts, Shalot lahavriach na'ashay into Seda. I think it means that he should not force her, coerce her, essentially, to adopt traditional rabbinic practices, because from her family, right, Shabbos is going to look very different. Right, so it says Shetishev Imo and something, right? Virgo Shabbos. She does not have to sit with him on Shabbos. Vishilotochal Eleha, something like that. Vishilotochala, it says Moadeha. She should not be forced by him to violate her own holidays, and so on and so forth.
Oh my
Right? So she doesn't necessarily have to sit in the candlelight on Shabbos, something like that. That's what it sounds like, right? Right? She's allowed to sit in the dark, right? She's allowed to observe her own holidays and so on and so forth. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, this is written into the ksuva of the Nasi. This is, I mean...
I can't imagine how they could marry each other.
Right, really, so this is really a marriage of love.
What? I don't know. I don't know if the Shadchan put them together. Right, that's right. Right, we don't have records of the in-law. You know, the in-law politics that followed in the wake. Although, because one of them was deceased. Anyhow, so that's, you get a sense, and you continue. Now, if you look, if you look at the second, sort of the second to last full line, or maybe the third to last line, says in mefur, right? The kasev in mefurish la'el. If you're familiar with that language from a traditional tuba, sharir v'kayam, mm-hmm. right? So in other words, right? It's a lot of the traditional rabbinic language, but then there are these additional arrangements that are written in. Now, if you look at the bottom, it's hard to make out some of those, but those are names. If you look in the middle bottom, you see Aharon bar signatures. Now, how many signatures do we have on our traditional ketubot? Two. Does this look like two signatures to you? It's a lot more. Karaite ketubot have 10 signatures. And if you're curious where that comes from, it too is biblical. When were there 10 people at a wedding signing ceremony of some sort?
Miglat Rut.
Yes, exactly right. That's correct. 100%, right? There are 10 people. That's where we learn that we had 10 people for Sheva Brachot, etc. And that's the source for the Karaite law, the Karaite practice to have 10 signatories on a ketubah. In fact, I saw online, I was curious to learn about this, and I Googled and I happened to chance upon a contemporary wedding in which the daughter is from a Karaite family, and it's happening now. That's right, exactly. And so the Chatan, who is, I think, not a Karaite, I don't know if he's Jewish, he's not a Karaite, he's narrating some of the details of the wedding. He explains that they have 10 signatories on the ketubah. He says our practice is that men and women alike are permitted to sign, but there need to be 10 signatories on the ketubah. That's what he says is the Karaite practice. I don't know. I don't know the history of it, but apparently that's... You find that on YouTube with regard to a contemporary Karaite wedding. So it seems like that's current practice as well. But it seems that they accommodated that position here. Probably, you know, they said, well, it's at least two.
Yeah.
Right? So it's sort of, it's acceptable to both sides. So this goes, I mean, the fact that you have the son of a Nasi and the daughter of Karaite and these kinds of arrangements and, you know, all of these sort of, you know, is remarkable. And again, if it was just some fringe group that it was just passing through,
right,
you wouldn't find such a thing. So I think this just gives you a sense of the ways in which these communities were interwoven, were embedded, how sometimes they just went their own separate ways and they fought, but very often we're fighting with those that we are closest to, or that we are embedded with in a single community. If someone is off in another right part of the world and has no connection with me, there's really little reason for me to fight such a battle. But if it's within my community and they're marrying one another from the most prominent of families and negotiating all sorts of complex agreements and writing them into the ketubah, now that's someone that's living with me. And so there's just all sorts of complexity that goes along with that. What? right. Anyhow, so, and we know, I mean, the history in the Jewish community of segments of the Jewish community marrying other segments of the Jewish community is a complicated one, and not just for the Ashkenazi community, to be frank. So, it's,
interesting.
We don't know. We found it in the Gniza. This is like gold. Yeah. I mean, this is gold. You know, what do we know? We don't know what it's representative of. It's hard to, it's anyone's guess, but it's pretty, you can frame it if you put it alongside your own. Okay. Okay. Anyhow. Okay. So we're going to stop here in terms of our overview of the Gaonim and the Karaites. Next time we're going to begin to mark the transition from the Babylonian Jewish community to the North African Jewish community, and we're going to be learning all about a famous legend or story of the four captives. So more on that, God willing, next week. Have a great day.